Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Bandy Lee, Assistant Clinical Professor in Law and Psychiatry at Yale University School of Medicine, who discusses the concern she and other mental health professionals have about President Trump's fitness for office. Energy security strategist Joel Gordis, who discusses the concept of distributed energy that promotes the creation of decentralized redundant electricity systems, mostly powered by renewable energy. And Noliwe Rooks, Director of American Studies at Cornell University, who talks about her book, Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Weeks after Brexit was embraced by British voters in the summer of 2016, UK financier Aaron Banks, who funded the Leave campaign, sat down for a fancy lunch with London's Russian ambassador, Alexander Yakovenko. Banks wanted to share with the ambassador growing ties between victorious Brexit supporters and the Trump campaign. Steve Bannon, a Brexit backer, had just been named as Trump's top strategist. Banks and Nigel Farage, a British Eurosceptic politician, were invited to a Trump fundraiser in Mississippi. Farage later became an unofficial Trump campaign surrogate. According to the Washington Post, the close ties between the Russians, Brexit supporters, and the Trump campaign are under investigation in Britain and in the United States by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Democrats are exploring the theory that Brexit activists and funders acted as a conduit between the Kremlin and the Trump campaign as a possible back channel. Contacts between Brexit advocates and top Trump political advisors goes back to 2013 when Farage first met Steve Bannon, who was then running the right-wing Breitbart website. At the time, Farage led the anti-European Union UK Independence Party and maintained high-level contacts with Russian diplomats. Life for rural migrants in Beijing became more precarious 3 years ago when the city government adopted a plan to cap the megacity's population at 23 million. A major crackdown ensued on migrant communities and schools as they were blamed for straining the city's infrastructure and public services. According to the Christian Science Monitor, Beijing officials demolished 23 square miles of illegal structures, an area the size of Manhattan. Most of the destroyed buildings were owned and occupied by migrants, including schools that catered to migrants' children who were shut out of public schools. Many urban industries, like construction and sanitation, are staffed by migrant labor. In order to deter migration, China has long restricted providing social services to a person's birth city or town. These Mao-era rules now make it nearly impossible for migrant children to access public education in Beijing. In response, underground migrant schools were opened, which often tend to have poorly trained teachers and substandard facilities. The U.S. Justice Department has reopened the murder investigation into the 1955 slaying of Emmett Till, a 14-year-old African-American from Chicago who was murdered while visiting relatives in Mississippi. Emmett's badly mutilated body was found days after the teenager allegedly whistled and made lewd comments toward a white woman. Decades later, the woman, Carol Bryant, recanted her story during an interview with researcher Timothy Tyson, author of the book The Blood of Emmett Till. The brutal murder of Emmett Till played a critical role in galvanizing the civil rights movement. Emmett's mother displayed her son's body in an open casket during the funeral in Chicago. Photos of his body were published in black newspapers and magazines across the U.S. At the time, two white men, including Bryant's husband, were charged with his murder, but were acquitted by an all-white jury. Emmett's cousin, Deborah Watts, who runs the Emmett Till Legacy Foundation, is grateful that the killing is getting another look. Newly elected Alabama Democratic Senator Doug Jones recently introduced a bill that would require the U.S. government to release information on unsolved civil rights-era murders. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo. ¶¶
During his presidential campaign, and over the last 12 months of his presidency, grave questions have been raised about Donald Trump's mental health and stability. In the estimation of many mental health professionals, both his rhetoric and decisions made have called into question his fitness for office. While there certainly is room for debate on the difference between an individual's idiosyncrasies and a serious mental health condition, there's no dispute regarding Donald Trump's penchant for lying. A Washington Post investigation revealed that since taking office in January 2017, Trump has made more than 2,000 false or misleading claims. While he averaged 4.9 lies a day in his first 100 days, that average grew to 5.6 lies daily toward the end of his first year in the Oval Office. In the words of the reporters covering this story, the longer the president has been in the job, the more frequently he touts an assortment of exaggerated, dubious, or false claims. During a conference titled Duty to Warn at Yale University last April, a group of psychiatrists warned that Donald Trump has a dangerous mental illness and is not fit to lead the U.S. The gathering was chaired by Dr. Bandy Lee, assistant clinical professor in law and psychiatry at Yale University's School of Medicine, who has since gone on to edit a book titled The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, and more recently briefed members of Congress on her and other mental health professionals' concern about the psychological state of the president. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Lee, who discusses her concern about President Trump's fitness for office.
First, let me make clear I'm speaking for myself and not for Yale. When I organized the conference, it was to address the ethical issue about speaking about public figures. You may have heard of the Goldwater Rule, which is an ethical guideline not to diagnose a public figure from afar. But we thought if there was a restriction on our speech, then did we have a positive duty to speak out about a public figure when there is danger involved? And the conference led to a lot of media attention. Following that, hundreds and hundreds of mental health professionals came forth speaking about the same concern that they saw, basically that Mr. Trump in the office of the presidency was a danger to the nation and the international community.
Dr. Lee, from your perspective and those of the contributors to your book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, what are some of the most troubling signs you see from Donald Trump since he took office in the White House 1 year ago?
Yes, I am a expert on violence. I've been devoting my career to studying, predicting, and preventing violence. And what was most troubling for me was his tendency for violence. And in fact, many people were speaking about how he was unique or how his personality was different from others. For me, he was fairly typical of the violent offender population I see. I probably have seen over 1,000 individuals with the same kind of manifestations. And so the tendency for violence, usually future violence is predicted by past violence. And so when you see someone who is verbally aggressive, who boasts about sexual assault, who incites violence at his rallies, who endorses violence in his speeches, is attracted to violence and powerful weapons, and then continually taunts a hostile nation with nuclear power, that is an individual who is likely to be violent in the future and probably become more violent over time as the stresses of the presidency grow on him.
The threat of violence is disturbing and could create a threat to the community. But of course, someone who holds the most militarily powerful office in the entire planet, their access to the use of nuclear weapons really creates a frightening potential scenario. And Dr. Lee, I would ask you, What in your mind are some of the scenarios you've considered in going public with your concerns generally and gathering around you these other mental health professionals who similarly see a threat to our life and our security here in this country?
He has at his sole disposal the power to launch nuclear arsenal that could destroy the world many times over. And this is an individual to whom that would not be a deterrent, but actually be tempting and attractive simply for its force. And so in terms of danger, we cannot rule out everything from everyday danger and violence-prone followers whose violence he has encouraged, and everyday acts of bullying, to gun deaths that have escalated, to conflicts with our allied nations, and threats from hostile nuclear powers, to extinction of the human species. These are all within the realm of possibility. It is a frightening possibility, but it does not help to silence the warnings and to deny what is actually in front of us. Congress is controlled by Republicans who would not take action, we were told, by the Democratic lawmakers. And that is why I've chosen to go public with this. And as shocking and distressing as it may sound, it is actually less anxiety-inducing to actually know what is happening and to face what is happening and know that we can have solutions.
That was Dr. Bandy Lee, assistant clinical professor in law and psychiatry at Yale University's School of Medicine and editor of the book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. 27 psychiatrists and mental health experts assess a president. For more perspectives on President Trump's mental health, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The concept of distributed energy, that is, energy systems that are small, redundant, and mostly powered by renewable energy, is slowly gaining ground as a response to weather disasters. Distributed energy can also improve resilience in responding to outages caused by climate disruption, as well as cyber and physical attacks targeting a nation's energy infrastructure. Joel Gordis, a Connecticut-based energy security strategist, has for many years been focused on the importance of designing energy systems that are resilient against such threats. He recently testified before the Connecticut Public Utilities Regulatory Authority about the issue. At that hearing, Gordis called on the state to incentivize electric utilities to decentralize the energy grid in exchange for healthy rates of return. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Gordis about the progress being made and the obstacles that remain to make distributed energy decentralized energy grids a reality across the U.S.
The problem is when there's a disaster or something, they concentrate on what the cause of that disaster was, rather than looking at it as an all-hazards approach. In order to do that, you have to look at the following types of problems that can arise. First is a fuel supply interruption with cost escalation going with it. That's happened to us in the past over oil when we were much more dependent on the Middle East. Then there's the physical security of the generation, transmission, distribution, and control systems. And that includes, when I talk about physical security, all forms of natural disasters, including those from climate change. So climate change is just one type of disaster that can take place. Then there's foreign dependency and disruption of globalized supply chains for components and critical materials. For instance, every plant and every system has to have what are called step-up transformers. Most of these are manufactured overseas and are very large and very difficult to move. So you have the problem of foreign manufacture and the idea that the transport is very difficult. Then cyber threats. Well, this is one of the newest ones, but then again, it isn't. I've been talking about cyber threats since the 90s. and people thought I was a little bit crazy. In fact, the siting council here in Connecticut would not let me even use the word until two members intervened to force that to take place. Then there are combined or blended combinations of what I've just mentioned, all the above. For instance, there might be a physical attack accompanied by a cyber attack taking place at the same time. Last of all are what we call unintended consequences. For instance, adding complexity to an already tightly coupled complex system, which is our electric grid. Something that takes place in a complex system is if something happens on one end of the grid, in certain instances, it can almost instantaneously have an effect on the other part of the grid due to this complexity. So those are the threats that we potentially face on energy security for the electric grid.
Joel Gordis, how do distributed energy resources address those threats?
Well, right now we have the centralized electric grid. And that's part of the problem, is everything is connected to everything else. And what we need to begin to start doing is decentralizing the electric grid. And that means very specific things. And I still hark back to the guru of decentralization, a fellow named Amory Lovins, who was the co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute. And in 1982, he and his then wife, L. Hunter Lovins, wrote a book called Brittle Power, and it was written for the Department of Defense, and then about a year later was released for the general public. This is what Amory and Hunter Lovins basically say, and I totally agree with this, that there should be many small units of supply and distribution. They should be geographically dispersed. They should be interconnected with many units, not dependent on just a few. They should be able to operate if they're in isolated modes. There should be some storage to provide a buffer, so failures tend to be gradual. Short links should be used at the distribution level and employ qualities of user controllability.
Is there any particular kind of energy that lends itself more than others to being used as distributed energy?
Well, basically, there should be many forms of energy. You should have more than one source in a good microgrid. And otherwise, you might have a large solar array. If you have wind capability, some wind, battery storage is what you definitely should have. And even fossil fuel types of small generators to take up any slack when you don't have the wind blowing or the sun isn't shining. So it takes into account a number of different fuels so that you have that capability of running under any circumstance.
Do you see any progress in moving toward distributed energy?
Connecticut has a limited program for what we call microgrids, but it's so limited and so underfunded that they're only doing about, from the beginning till now, and that's about over a four-year period, about seven different projects or so. Hopefully they're going to do more. The military, I think, is pointing the way, and what we learned from their experience can be adapted to the rest of the nation. Now, other states are also engaged in it to different levels. And I don't have a good fix on that, but I think some states may be far more ambitious than what's happening here. So that's something to look at and hopefully start to make an impact. I'm afraid it's going to take some sort of a cyber attack in conjunction with an ice storm or a blizzard to get people thinking of, geez, maybe we really should be doing the decentralization.
That was Joel Gordis, a Connecticut-based energy security strategist. Learn more about the concept of distributed energy systems by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. We'll be right back. Randy Weingarten, who leads the 1.6 million member American Federation of Teachers Union, declared in August that President Trump's education secretary, Betsy DeVos, is the most ideological anti-public education person to ever be nominated or confirmed to that position. DeVos, who never attended public school or worked in one, has devoted her life to allowing parents to choose the schools their children attend, either charter or private schools using public funds, and decreasing the federal government's role in education. DeVos bankrolled a ballot measure in Michigan to create a public school voucher system that was soundly defeated by a 2-to-1 margin. She then spent millions of dollars of her own money to elect legislators who then made deep cuts to public school budgets and promoted unaccountable for-profit charter schools in the state. Now almost half of Michigan's charter schools rank near the bottom, and Michigan dropped from 28th to 41st in reading skills and from 27th to 42nd in math compared with other states. Your reporter spoke with No Leeway Rooks, Director of American Studies at Cornell University, who talks about her new book titled Cutting School: Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. Here, Professor Rooks condemns school privatization efforts and contends that publicly funded schools are essential to quality, equal education for all and an indispensable element to build a democratic society.
Taxpayer-supported public education starts for the entire country. It had been in certain parts of the East Coast, in Massachusetts in particular, from the 1600s. But it's really post-Reconstruction that the rest of the country gets with the idea of, we should use taxpayer dollars to educate all of our citizens, regardless of wealth, before 1890 to 1920, that period. You know, education was really something only for the very wealthy. It was mostly private. You know, people were sent to Europe. They were sent to private boarding schools in the U.S. And the idea of educating the masses of Americans really is a kind of quintessentially American intervention, that no matter who you are, no matter your social station, there's something about education that would be valuable for you. And this is a way that we can start to educate all Americans around what citizenship means, that we can define a particular kind of civic imagination and a goal of democracy, of what kinds of citizens we want to participate in this experiment in democracy where, you know, voters, where everyone, where citizens of the country are engaging in setting the policy and setting the direction. That was the ideal.
When we see the drive toward privatizing our education system in this country through charter schools, the movement towards school vouchers, the whole notion of school choice, which underlines those, and a system called virtual education, tell us a bit about how that affects the quality of education. These companies obviously are in it to make a buck. They're making profit here by getting into privatizing the education system. But what's the effect on the students?
So one of the terms that I came up with to talk about this moment, where we really do have an unprecedented move toward dismantling what we consider traditional public education, what that's being replaced by with high concentrations of poor people and high concentrations of people of color are charter schools, which are publicly financed but privately run. So they're not beholden to the same kinds of oversight and regulation as traditional public schools. But they depend on taxpayer dollars, or there's an offshoot of the homeschooling movement for virtual charter schools. These are schools where children as young as 5 years old can get the entirety of their education through computers. They're rarely having contact with other students, rarely having contact with teachers, and it costs school districts almost the same amount as a brick-and-mortar school. Or you'll have something like these alternatively certified teachers like Teach for America and other entities like that, which charge often struggling school districts between $2,000 to $5,000 per teacher that they supply as a kind of finder's fee. The thing about all of this is it's supposed to address the underachievement of children of color, low test scores, low graduation rates, the persistent problems that we see in certain kinds of communities. But the solutions that we've come up with are undoubtedly, like we're clear, making certain businesses very, very wealthy. Teach for America, which I mentioned, supplies teachers to these kinds of districts. The last I looked in 2016, it's been about a year, but they were worth almost $400 million. Wealthy children, upper middle class children, do not go to schools where their teachers are overwhelmingly trained with 5 weeks of training in the summer. And put in classes, there'd be a complete uprising if you went into an upper middle class neighborhood or a wealthy neighborhood or a private school and touted the fact that the majority of our teachers have only had 5 weeks of training. So the question that I started to ask is, but why are the forms of education, the ways, the methods, the thinking about education so very different depending on the race and class of the children we're talking about educating? And there's something about that that started to feel fundamentally wrong to me.
That was Noliwe Rooks, Director of American Studies at Cornell University, and author of the new book titled Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. For more discussion of the issues raised in Rooks' book, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. Segments on today's program were previously broadcast. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRGU in Philadelphia, WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, KUGS in Bellingham, Washington, and more than 60 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.